8. One Man's Family, 2008 to 2014. The election of 2008 and Saturday Night Live were very good for, and to, each other. When Sarah Palin appeared on the show with pseudo-Sarah, Tina Fey, SNL captured its largest audience in 14 years. The bounty overflowed. Even 30 Rock, the Faye Michaels sitcom, saw a big bump in its ratings as Tina-craving viewers followed her to prime time. So it was that a presidential election helped repopularize Saturday Night Live, bringing in virgin viewers who'd never watched before, as well as returnees who perhaps had strayed for a spell. The obvious question, could the show hang on to that audience? Luckily, SNL's perpetual search for recurring characters that can pop up several times per season struck gold when Bill Hader, one of the most talented and versatile SNL performers of the century so far, and one of the most popular among fellow cast members, introduced Stefan, a sexually adventurous Manhattan party boy. Co-created with writer John Mulaney, Stefan burst forth when he became a special nightlife correspondent for Weekend Update with Seth Meyers. Androgynous, jittery, and smoky-voiced, Stefan would describe to Meyers the latest hottest club in New York, always some dank cavern populated with oddballs, hipsters, and midgets, and Meyers would plead for more family-friendly haunts. Meyers also chastised Stefan for using the insensitive term midgets, and smitten with Meyers, Stefan finally obliged and changed it. He henceforth would call little people fun-sized, he said. The character caught on quickly, even though Hader violated a cardinal rule of the show by breaking, laughing at his own material, at some point in his invariably risible report. Seth Meyers, cast member. Bill just showing up was so exciting because we never quite had someone like him in my time on the show, someone who is both an incredible impressionist and also incredible with characters, and he was doing both. So that was a skill he had that certainly, in that era of the show, he was unparalleled at. Paul Rudd, host. Hader is somebody whose talent is insane. His ear is amazing. It isn't even like he's doing impressions like Rich Little or somebody. And I've noticed this from just hanging out with the guy. Bill can do anybody, anybody. He just hears intonations and he can absolutely replicate it. I think of the Alan Alda impression that he did. He'd never done an Alan Alda impression, but that day it was just, let's do Alan Alda. And he says, I'll work on an Alan Alda. And he just did it. He'll home in on something. I know he works on it, but it's an innate ability. He doesn't hang his hat on it either. It's weird he never even talks about it. All he talks about are books and old movies.
Kristen Wiig, cast member. What Bill Hader does with his voice is so unique and unbelievable at times, and on top of it, he makes the character hilarious. You find yourself just watching him with your mouth open like, what the fuck?
Bill Hader, cast member. John Mulaney and I would write those Stefans. Actually, I was more of an editor, and then if something needed a weird voice, I know we did one of Donald Duck having a Vietnam nightmare. Those were things that I would come up with. I can do Donald Duck. Weird sound things were usually me. John Mulaney, writer. My initial approach was, boy, this is a really weird character, and maybe it'll be on about 12:50 a.m., and that would be a great victory. Bill and I wrote it as a sketch first when Ben Affleck was there, and I remember it was very funny to us. We had a good sense of the character that week that we first wrote it. Stefan and Ben Affleck played brothers who were pitching a movie to a big studio, but they were not on the same page about what the movie was about. So that rhythm of him listing things that it would have was originally in the format of a movie pitch. That sketch aired and did okay. It was like a weirdo thing towards the end of the night, but some people really noticed it. Our friends liked it, and that was really gratifying. The second time, we wrote it as a sketch. Stefan was pitching a new restaurant, and his brother that time was Bradley Cooper. A lot of jokes were cool, but it wasn't quite clicking. There were too many people on stage for what was essentially one guy talking. So it wasn't until we put it on update that the added electricity came to it. Then it was either Seth Meyers or Doug Abel who said, he should describe restaurants, describe clubs, and he quickly became a New York lifestyle consultant. Seth Meyers. I deserve no credit for Stefan other than enjoying setting him up for jokes, but the one thing I will say is, they had originally written it as a sketch, and the one suggestion I had was, every time they would write it as a sketch, any aware host who read the script would see the host had no laughs in the piece, like it's all Stefan. And if you're a movie star sitting next to Stefan, you probably realize at some point how little people are paying attention to you. So I was the one who suggested, as someone who loves playing a straight man, that Update might just be a better home for Stefan, at no point ever expecting it would succeed at the level it did. Bill Hader. The first Update one we did it at Dress, and it went fine. While they were picking sketches for the show, we went over in a corner, and there was one line that didn't work. It was a club owner called Amnesia Bernstein, which we thought was funny but got nothing at Dress. And then they go, "Meeting," and I just said, "Oh, shit, I gotta go." So I left and told John, "Just put in something." Later on air, I got to where it was on the cards, and he had put, "Club owner Gay Liotta," and that was the first time I saw it, and I started laughing. And that started this thing where John was like, "Oh, that was fun. I'm going to do this every time now." But these things get highly exaggerated where people say that every time I did Stefan there was shit that I didn't know was going to be on the cards. That's not necessarily true. John Mulaney. When we did the first one, Bill broke ridiculously. He completely fell apart, which is really funny to me because he felt really bad about breaking on air. He has a really strong, good work ethic, and he thought each time I would be annoyed at him for breaking. But of course I thought it was awesome. He was trying to keep it together so much that it became fun to put in things purposefully to make him break. I was also very aware that people can have comedy purity issues with breaking on a live show. But I thought it was so funny and genuine that first time that he laughed that I always just wanted to keep it funny and genuine by messing with him. I would put in new jokes after Dress, and sometimes he would see them right before air. It wasn't like it was the first time he ever saw it on the cue card. I would say, "This is now this, this is now this, this is now that." And then Andy Samberg would stand next to the camera with his arms folded, staring at Bill the whole time. So there was a lot of pressure on trying to make him laugh. It was definitely a group effort. Bill Hader. The way I knew that the first one worked was two things. After I finished it, Jim Downey came over to me and went, "That's the funniest thing I've ever seen you do on the show." It was very sweet. And then when I went to the after party, Lauren's assistant was like, "Do you want to go over and sit at Lauren's table?" I remember me and John Mulaney sitting at Lauren's table and him saying, "That was really great, that was awesome." And then two shows later, I remember John coming up to me on Thursday and saying, "They want another Stefan." And I was like, "Wow, okay, cool." And when we did that second one, it got a giant recognition applause when I rolled out. And I remember seeing Andy Samberg on the other side past the cue cards, standing next to John Mulaney when that was happening, and Andy put his arm around John and hugged him like, "Congratulations, buddy, you got a big hit on the show." It's cool to see that during the sketch, looking out and seeing Andy with John. John Mulaney. One time, Spud Webb was mentioned in a club, and all I did was put Spud Webb in again, but just in a different club. Bill Hader. Do you know who Spud Webb is? He's this really tiny, tiny basketball player, so I started laughing, and then I see Spud Webb is in the second one, which I did not know, so I caught myself, but then Seth went, "Whoa, Spud Webb pulling double duty!" And I was gone. I was completely gone. There was no going back. I was just gone. John Mulaney. The biggest one I think ever was when I put in a whole new joke. Stefan asked Seth, "You know Blackula, the Black Dracula? Well, this one was the Jewish Dracula." And Seth asked, "What's his name?" And Stefan says, "Sidney Applebaum." I had told him about it right before, and he started laughing really hard, and I said, "Okay, don't think about it again. I just told you it's on the cue card." Then on air, you could see his eyes, because it's a longer joke, it's not just a little detail. You could see from his eyes that he was already gone from the beginning of the joke. Then the cue card turned, and he sees the whole thing he has to say. That was very satisfying, because he broke before he even got to the joke. Bill Hader. Another reason I think I broke doing Stefan, without sounding too pretentious, is that the character was very nervous, very tactile. And I would get into this kind of mind space when I did that character where I was always on the edge. I was just so amped up that one little pinprick and I would start laughing. They gave me this Ed Hardy shirt with these long sleeves so I could kind of hide my face in the sleeves when I broke. And this guy I based it on was a guy who used to serve coffee in Chelsea and was always touching his face, in the way that people on ecstasy are always touching things. And it just kinda happened where I would cover my face. Stefan should not be on live television. Where his head's at and his personality are not conducive to delivering the news on live television. He's very nervous. I went to Lorne at an after-party once and I said, "I'm very sorry I keep breaking as Stefan. I'm a little nervous because I've broken every single time I've done it, so now I feel that the audience is waiting for me to break, and I feel a lot of guilt about this." And Lorne said, "Well, if what you're saying isn't funny, then we have a problem. But what you're saying is so outrageous, everyone's laughing. It's when what you're saying isn't funny and you're trying to save the sketch, or you're trying to pull focus away from other performers, or pull focus away from the idea of the sketch and the writing and just trying to pull it all to you, then that's when we have a problem." And I said, "Okay." I think Lorne secretly loved it because the audience thought it was great. But I should say, for the record, every time I broke, I would get angry with myself. I would laugh up there, and then this feeling of guilt would kind of ebb through me. I'd feel very guilty. So after most Stefans, I'd have my head down, and I'd be pissed because I'd laughed. In my head, I was always going, "Don't fuck this up." That became pretty much the prevailing feeling before every single Stefan. "People like this. Don't fuck it up." And then it became, "Please, let's not do him as much, because we're running out of stuff, and I think people are seeing where we're going." It's the same thing that happens with anybody who has a big sketch that the audience really likes. On the Mick Jagger show, I did Stefan, and it was one of the coolest things ever. It got to the point that Seth would start announcing it, and all he had to say was, "Well, it's tourist season in New York right now," and everybody would go bonkers. That was a really cool feeling, but then I would get really nervous. Like, "Oh God, there's a lot of expectation on this." Seth Meyers. Another thing, which is more of a credit to Mulaney and Hader than anything else, is Stefan was this great joke delivery system, and he could have come on and been Stefan, and it could have worked great without there being this relationship between him and me. But the writers were smart enough to realize that if you have another thing to play on every time he came out, that was another layer to the piece. And it was not just that he went to these nightclubs, and there was all this really densely written, detail-oriented writing that I don't think people fully appreciated, but there was this second element that we had this budding relationship. Bill Hader. Stefan being into Seth was something that just happened naturally. The thing I liked about Stefan was that his being gay was never part of the joke. He was just bad at his job and did a lot of drugs, and you think he might be lying, that these things he talked about might not really be true. And then, of course, he would be into Seth, and Seth wouldn't like him, so it was just organic that this relationship happened. The first rule I learned in improv class was that you want to make the other person look good, and that's what Seth did better than anybody. Even when you had kind of a shitty update, he would make you look good. It's so easy to play it angry, but he would never get angry. He thought, "I invited these people to Weekend Update for a reason. I want to work this out." Seth Meyers. The approach I had to my era on Update, which I made early on, which is that a lot of times when people write Update features, they write the Update anchor as frustrated with the other character, Which makes sense, because all the time you're introducing somebody coming out with, like, shopping tips or somebody coming out with how to prepare for a Super Bowl party. And of course, they never come out and actually do that. They're immediately off the rails. And someone said to me, a fan basically made the observation, that when I was frustrated with the characters, they were also frustrated with the characters. And so I made the decision to be just always delighted with whoever came out on Weekend Update, Stefan included. John Mulaney. I was very surprised to see the number of Stefans we'd done by Bill's last episode. We tried to space them out. We resisted doing them all the time, but by the end we had done a lot. It might have been 16 or 17. Throughout them, it seemed kind of natural that Stefan would be attracted to Seth. And then from there, joke by joke, we just started to put together this whole narrative of Stefan trying to steal Seth from his girlfriend, now wife, and it was something that I thought people seemed to like, an added element that was a lot of fun for us. It was very cool to see how bizarrely the whole romance of Seth and Stefan really resonated in the last one that we did. Bill Hader. Paul McCartney came up to me and said, "My daughter is a clothing designer." And I was like, "Uh-huh." And he said, "This guy that works with her, he's that way." And he put his hands over his mouth like Stefan. And my wife was behind me, and not quietly, she went, "Oh my God, Paul McCartney is doing your character to you." And I was like, "Thank you, sir. I can die now. Thank you very much. I'm going to go throw up right now." It was crazy having Paul McCartney do your character to you. Robin Williams did the same thing. When he was on the show to do What's Up With That, he said, "I love that character that you do." And he started doing it. I was like, "Thank you very much. That's bonkers." Betty White was actually not the oldest person ever to perform on Saturday Night Live. Jazz great Hubie Blake sang on a 1979 show at the age of 96, or 92, depending on whom you ask. But on May 8, 2010, Betty White, then 88, became the oldest person ever to host. Her appearance had as much to do with the new as with the old. It came about because of a viewer campaign that began on Facebook at the beginning of the year. Organized loosely as a group called Betty White to Host SNL, Please, White's internet friends grew into a groundswell, and she was booked to host the penultimate show of the season. White didn't just stroll lazily through the show, either. She was put to work on many sketches, including a new version of The Delicious Dish, a risque spoof of an NPR cooking show. Earlier versions starred Alec Baldwin, with former cast members Molly Shannon and Anna Gasteyer returning to co-star. Lorne Michaels also invited Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, and Maya Rudolph, all mothers, to appear in this, the Mother's Day episode. Ratings went through the Rockefeller Center roof, and the White episode ranked as the biggest event in SNL annals since its election year triumphs of 2008. Lorne Michaels, executive producer. We asked Betty White to host a bunch of times beforehand. I think whenever we'd ask, it just wasn't the right time for her. We were all crazy about her. It worked out great because doing it for the Mother's Day show was a big deal.
Betty White, host. I have no idea where the big campaign to get me to host came from. It came out of left field. It seems that somebody put it on, what was it, Tweet? I don't even have a computer, so I don't understand any of that stuff. But they got enough people asking that they invited me to do it. I'd said no about 3 times over the years. I'm such a California product, and the show is so very New York, that I thought I'd be like a fish out of water. But they said, "No, we'd really like you to do it," etc. And my agent said, "You have to do it." And I said, "No, I don't. I don't think so." He said, "Yes, you do. Well, I have great faith in my agent," so I said, "Okay." And then I went back to New York, and I was panicky. I thought, "What am I doing? Haven't I learned to say no?" I had such qualms.
Ken Among, supervising producer. Betty worked just as hard as any other host. She was here late at night doing pre-tapes. She came to every rehearsal. She was amazing.
Betty White. I love live television. When I started in the business for 4 years, I was on 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, live, with no script or anything like that. It was just my show, and we had to make it work, so I wasn't afraid of the live aspect of SNL. It was fun to get that feeling of immediacy, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. When I started in television, it was that new thing in the corner of the room where people were actually talking on camera. Comedy shows are altogether different these days. The audience has changed so much. It's a tough audience because they've heard every joke and they've heard every storyline, and they know where you're going before you even start. Lorne is a genius. He put things together that made me comfortable on all sides. He's the one who decided to bring the other girls back, not just to support me, but because he thought it would be great. So he brought Tina and Amy and all the girls. I was sure happy to be on stage with them. Amy Poehler, cast member. I was so impressed by her stamina, and she's just so sharp. A lot of the ways that the women of SNL keep in contact is that we have a text chain where we send pictures of our kids, and it was really cool to have Maya, Tina, Anna, Rachel, Molly, and me, and everyone's kids there. It just felt like the circle of life. Maya Rudolph, cast member. When I first started the show, they had a Mother's Day special, but that was a rarity. They don't do them every year. Back then, I was 27 and had no kids, so it was totally different. One of the things that made our cast able to have this unique experience is that all the women who were there had become mothers. I always think of SNL as like being in a comedy war together, like we were all in the same platoon.
Lorne Michaels. Jay-Z coming on and then giving it up for Betty White in that intro before he sang the second song was fabulous.
Betty White. I was aware of Jay-Z. It was great to meet him. The whole week was really a delight. I hope it worked. It was such fun to do. We laughed our way through it, all of us. Of course, I had to do a lot of eating crow with my agent. Amy Poehler. When I came back to host, it was a little strange because your experience there as a cast member is that you're one of many, and then suddenly you're special, and it's kind of hard to buy the idea that you're special enough to be the host. It was strange, but it was also really, really lovely to be back and not have the same fear of, am I going to be in anything? Looking at the show from the point of view of behind that door and walking out from behind the band is very strange. The only other time I'd stood behind the band that way was when we rehearsed musical stuff, but I'd never walked through that door, and that was a big deal for me. There were these new people when I hosted. It was their first show, and I liked watching the experience through their eyes. And I remember how I started doing a thing when I was at SNL, which Bill Hader kind of took over, and I think Taryn does it now, where I would just take the new cast members out to dinner. Vanessa Bayer. It was so weird meeting cast members and being starstruck by them and then having to act like it was a normal thing. I remember calling my brother and saying, "Fred emailed me!" He emailed all the new cast. And Bill took the new cast members out to dinner and they put us in a private room. I had never even been in a private room in a restaurant except for my grandpa's 75th birthday. Nassim Pedrad, cast member. I was born in Tehran and came to California when I was about 3 years old and definitely grew up watching the show as a little kid. SNL was my dream job, but I was tucked away in the suburbs and my parents were immigrants and no one knew how to even pronounce my name. I was so removed from the entertainment industry that I'm not sure at a young age I understood it was at all possible. I remember thinking, it'd be great to be a cast member, but in the same way that it would be great to be an astronaut or Madonna. I had no idea how to get there. I started doing theater in school and eventually majored in theater in college, and I think timing is everything with most things, but especially with SNL. I had done a one-woman show called Me, Myself, and Iran that Tina Fey saw, and she suggested to Lauren that I audition for SNL. I also happened to be performing at the Groundlings, so he came out and saw me, and after that I got flown out to New York for my first of two auditions. I had definitely heard all of the bad stories about SNL, but, you know, from another era. I knew Kristen and a couple of other people from the show, and they said it had toned down a bit. And I have to say, I was still really surprised when I got there as to how kind everybody was to one another.
Taryn Killam, cast member. My parents watched SNL. My first relationship with it was we owned a Best of Eddie Murphy VHS that I would watch repeatedly and quote Buckwheat and Learn to Be a Ho and Little Richard Simmons and the Tooth Fairy sketch. We still have a video of my little brother and I think I'm 7 or 8, so he's 3 or 4, doing Hans and Franz in our house in Big Bear. And it's an odd thing to be on a show and start to shape the voice of a show that originally shaped who I am, that very much defined for me what I thought was funny and what I thought was cool. Jay Farrow, cast member. My comedy came from not having any friends. You know, when you don't have a lot of friends, you talk to yourself and make stuff up, and you take this world you've made up and turn it into something that's applicable to comedy. I learned that I could do voices at 6, and I became one of the funny kids. I made people laugh, and that got me out of a lot of trouble. I didn't get to do a lot when I was growing up as far as just wilding out, doing what the other neighborhood kids did. I was sheltered. We had a very good base, my mom and dad and I. A kind of Christian base, and that really has helped me. It's kind of like cement, so you don't end up as a crazed celebrity with everybody talking about you on Twitter. That's not going to happen. But it's a new world to Jay Farrow. I'm still getting used to it. Bobby Moynihan, cast member. I spent about 6 months working on an audition, then I sent in a tape. When I got called to come in and audition, I thought, there is no way I'm going to get it. I auditioned, and then the next day they brought me in to talk to Lorne, and I couldn't believe it. I think I waited like 9 hours on the couch outside his office. It was the LeBron James episode, and LeBron James was late, so I had to wait until he had come in and finished everything. Then I talked to Lorne, and it was like a first date. He just wanted to know everything. He asked me about my family, where I went to school. He asked me if I was a fan of the show. I'm a super fan, and so I had a lot to talk about and a lot of questions to ask about the first season and the whole start of it. I remember him saying, "Is there anything in here you like?" And I said, "Oh, I know that's your world's best boss mug. It was from a Steve Carell show, an office sketch." And Lorne goes, "Oh, that mug next to those Emmys?" And I was going, "Oh, you set me up for that." But he was super nice and wonderful, and he said something along the lines, I had a very long beard and very long hair, of, "Why don't you cut your hair and shave your beard and come back?" And I did, but he had left to go to the Emmys, and then they called me back in again and said, "We think we'll start you in January." But it was never definite, and I went, "I think I just got it. I don't know." And then the writer's strike happened, like, the next day. And so for 9 months I just sat in my apartment going, "I think I got it, but now it's gone, so I have no idea." I think my hiring was not the first thing on their list, so I just heard nothing for 9 months. Then I heard, through the grapevine, that the writer's strike was coming to an end, and the day it ended I got a call from SNL, and I was like, "This is it! They're calling to tell me to come to work on Monday." But they were like, "Hey, Maya Rudolph had a baby during the writer's strike, so we have to hire a girl." And they hired Casey Wilson, and I was just devastated. I thought, that's it. It didn't happen. And I spent a couple of months in tears and ended up getting a couple of jobs in movies, and then Seth called me out of the blue. I was in Rome, and he said, "We're doing this web series called The Line that Bill Hader and Simon Rich wrote, and we'd love for you to play a part in it." And I thought that was my consolation prize, essentially. So I went and did it, and it was my second audition almost, just to see if they could work with me. And after 3 days they said, "Why don't you come back in and audition for SNL again?" Steve Higgins told me to watch Jimmy Fallon's audition. He said he knew I didn't play guitar and wasn't a big impression guy, but Jimmy did a whole bunch of things. I stayed up 3 days writing all new stuff. I thought, I'm going to show them 30 things I could do rather than just 3 characters and 3 impressions. Taryn Killam. The worst news about finding out I was hired on SNL was that Will Forte was leaving, because he is truly my favorite cast member of all time. He's just a genius. And we had orbited around each other from the Groundlings Theater, and so I got to see him at an event after I was hired, and he said to me, "It's a marathon, not a sprint." And that was the most valuable piece of advice ever, because you feel you're only as good as your most recent sketch. But it's a show that lives in reflection, and if you can look back on a season and have 2 pieces that people really talked about, that's a great year. Bill Hader said, if you can do 2 great sketches a season, you do 7 seasons, that's 14 sketches. That's enough for a best-of DVD. It's all numbers. We're all part of the Matrix. We were writing a sketch this week where they needed a macho guy, and I was the first choice. And Rob Klein said, literally, last year you were the 6th choice for the macho guy. It's weird. I came into a show of Jason, Bill, Andy, Fred, Bobby. I was the 6th white guy, and now I'm 2nd. My first season or two, there was a Huffington Post article that ranked cast members on a weekly basis. They had their own algorithm of screen time. Who did what is the best sketch? And I was the worst. I was just the worst. It's a dangerous pitfall. With a 40-year history, there's so much to compare yourself to. The shadow grows longer and darker the longer the show goes on. Now, we're not just compared to the original 75 cast, we're compared to 6 generations, versus the people who came before were compared to 5. And as the library gets deeper and deeper, a lot of things are similar to stuff that's been done on SNL. You also have to get to a place where you just forgive yourself and you say, well, my take's going to be different, and I'm going to see it through, and if people laugh, that's the goal. I'll go home on a break and watch an old episode on TV, and I still cannot believe I'm on that show. I still can't believe it's the same show. I came into this thing feeling like I don't want to be the one to break it. I still am not at a place where I can go, yeah, I'm just like those guys in the old episodes. Relatively few people who are living or who ever lived have experienced the peculiar and prestigious thrill of looking into an NBC color camera and shouting to several million people at once, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." Even higher status goes with the honor of hosting the show, a privilege known to a select elite. Although lame ringers have slipped through too, later lamented and regretted. Hosting more than once carries with it particular amenities, spoofed in sketches starring celebrities who try to one-up each other with boasts of multiple appearances. That began in 1990 when Steve Martin convened the first gathering of the 5-Timers Club for those who had hosted 5 times or more. As jobs go, it doesn't pay all that well. It requires a full week's unrelenting commitment, and the hours are late and punishing. But hosting Saturday Night Live is still looked upon as one of the most coveted gigs in television. Hosts are treated well, but hardly draped in velvet. Although one tradition could be considered a very pleasant perk, Tuesday night dinners given by Lorne Michaels for the host and a smattering of staff from the show at a private room in La Tanzi, a cozy midtown restaurant whose cuisine is classified as Jewish-Italian. It's not a glamorous or trendy place, but it's very comfortable. Invitations to these dinners are much prized. Bill Hader. Lorne would do these host dinners on Tuesday nights. We would write, and then at 8 o'clock someone would come to you and say, "Okay, you're going to the host dinner." And then you would go and eat this amazing Italian dinner with Lorne and the host and 5 or 6 other cast members, and now you're stuffed on pasta and you're sleepy, and yet you have to go back and write more. I never understood why they were on Tuesday nights. I always felt they should be on Monday. Like, after the pitch meeting, you could go, because everybody just goes home anyways. So why don't we do those on Monday? Ask Lorne, and he'll say, they've always been on Tuesday.
Lindsay Shukas, producer. As someone in charge of booking the host, I don't really try to book a host that I think is going to be terrible. It won't do us any favors, you know. We did once have a host miss a read-through. That's someone not being able to be there to read 40 sketches that were supposed to be in their voice. It was Jeff Bridges. He got sick. I remember having to call Lorne and say, Jeff Bridges cannot come in today. Then we were faced with the idea of picking the 12 sketches of 40 that are supposed to really be a showcase of the host, without the host. Obviously, we can figure out what's funny, but we don't really know what the host is going to be good at if they're not there. It was a little terrifying.
Justin Timberlake, host. I've never had a dress rehearsal go exactly like the show. Most of the people who come to dress are a little closer to the show, more diehard fans who want to get to dress rehearsal because they know they get to see sketches that aren't even going to air. The audience for the live show, at least with what I've found, are a slightly more mainstream, slightly more broad group. So there's things you can do in dress rehearsal that are a little more nuanced to the culture of the show, and things you can do in the live show that are more broad. I find that the best rule of thumb is that you have to forget most of what you put together for the week, and you just have to play off of the crowd. So if those 200 people in that audience are responding to what you're doing, I feel then that translates to television. John Hamm, host. After the first season that Mad Men aired, and Jen and I were in New York at a magazine party or something, I was on the cover of a magazine, which was a very new experience for me as well. And my agent at that time came up to me and said, you've been asked to host Saturday Night Live. And I must have had literally like a jaw-dropping thing. Wait, what? My agent said, yeah, they want you to host, whatever date it was. And Jen and I had literally just booked this trip to Greece, and finally I'm done with Mad Men. We're finally going on vacation. I'd never been to Greece. The ink wasn't even dry on that thing, and they said, oh, it's this week. And I said, I can't do it. I can't. I have this thing. My agent goes, okay, all right. And I thought, well, that opportunity came and went, but I've got to take care of myself and be a human being. So literally 2 days later they asked, what about this date? And it's like, yes, that I can do. So I remember being amazed and then crestfallen and then equally amazed when it came back to me. Hosting is an amazing experience. The only thing I can compare it to is the experience of being on a roller coaster and it's pulling you up the first hill, making that clacking sound. That basically is the week. You start hearing this clack, 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 clack. You're going up this hill, and you know that the ride's not going to go off the rails, and you also know the ride's going to be over in 90 minutes. But there's this mounting terror that you have to go through this 90-minute roller coaster ride. And God bless dress rehearsal, because if it was just one live show, it would be a very different experience. I never had a heart rate monitor on me, but I guarantee you, if you had strapped one to my chest at 11:34 all 3 times that I've hosted, it would be off the charts. And I'm not a guy who gets nervous in that way. But literally, when you're waiting there, you're 2 inches behind the drum kit, so the drum is like touching you in the face because it's a tiny, tiny space. You're literally walking sideways to get onto that set. People think it's a door to a hallway. No, it's a door to a crawl space, basically, and it's you and one of the stage managers. You can't hear anything but the band, and they just shove you out the door, and that's when you crest the hill and you start going on the ride.
Scarlett Johansson, host. I feel if you're going to host Saturday Night Live as many times as I have, you're fair game at that point to have people make fun of you. Anytime I see they're doing some kind of spoof of a scene that I did in a movie or another actor's playing me, a lookalike or anything, that is an incredibly surreal experience. I saw when Maya did me, and I thought she needed more time to fully exploit me the way she could have. I've poked fun at plenty of people when I've hosted. I don't know what would make me, like, less vulnerable to that. I have plenty of opportunities to look like $1 million. I'd rather look like, I don't know, someone's anus or something, which I know they'll probably turn me into, than look like Marilyn Monroe or whoever. If you're going to do Saturday Night Live, you want to play the anus. And that's probably the only time you ever want to play the anus. It's not a glamour job.
Paul Rudd, host. It's really exciting for me to host the show. I've now hosted it 3 times, and I feel like I have a connection to the show that I never had before I hosted. I live in New York, and it's such an important part of the city. I have a very strong affinity for the show. I remember as a kid watching Woody Allen movies made me want to move to New York, made me want to live in New York. There's just something about this city. And there are a few things that I think really encapsulate what New York is, and that we romanticize about it, and so many aspects of Saturday Night Live encapsulate that. At the end of the show, when everyone's on stage, as a kid I would watch that and go, "Oh my God, can you imagine? Now they're going to go to an after party." And then hearing Don Pardo's voice, and just even the shots of all the cast members at some different part of the city, whether they're at some sushi restaurant or out on some manhole with steam coming out of it, it was just like, it's fucking New York, man! And that music, and then seeing 30 Rock and the Marquee. When I'm hosting, I remember pulling up every time and thinking, oh my God, there it is. I can't shake it.
Scarlett Johansson. My name was once on some little part of a New Yorker cover, and I thought, oh man, I've really made it. I'm on the cover of the New Yorker. And I guess being spoofed on SNL is another I made it moment.
Robert De Niro, host. When I'm doing a movie and it has a particular type of scene, I always imagine it being made fun of on Saturday Night Live. I've watched the show ever since it started, and it's always been just a great show. It's harder to do than some people might think, and there's a little bit of pressure. Some of those skits are funnier than others to me, and probably to the audience. But you don't have time to think or worry about this or that, or whether you're good or bad. You just do it and hope for the best.
Cameron Diaz, host. I've never done any theater, so the live part is totally unique for me. But the entire process is completely different. It's obviously something that has been very well cultivated by the powers that be and by Lorne. You carry a lot of responsibility as host, but the cast makes you feel like you're capable of doing whatever you need to do. So I always feel like I'm just part of the ensemble. There is pressure, though. You don't want to be the one person who doesn't know how to deliver their lines, or the one who screws things up or doesn't understand the pace of things.
Chris Martin, host. Gwyneth had done the Garth and Cat sketch over the years, and I just thought it was fucking incredible. And I love Fred Armisen and Kristen Wiig, like everyone else does, and I was like, you know what, I'd really like to do that. So I just asked for their indulgence. And what was it like? It made me realize, you know what? I'm glad I'm a musician. For some reason, musicians are always drawn to comedians. In fact, I was on a plane with Sacha Baron Cohen, and we were talking about it. He said, maybe it's because you spend so much time on tour that you watch all the comedy that's available. A lot of actors want to be musicians. A lot of comedians want to be actors. And I think a lot of musicians secretly think they could be comedians. And sometimes it's good to be reminded, stick to your day job. Paul Rudd. I remember one of the things that proved to be tricky the first time I hosted is the whole reading of the cue cards thing, because there's no real lesson in how to do it. It's funny, there are ones that look like, oh God, they're totally reading cue cards, they're really bad at it. Or they're usually, and I'm guilty of this, actors who like to look at it, and then they'll try to look at the actors so that they're not actually looking at the cue cards, but it's the back and forth. When you go back and forth, that makes it look like you're reading cue cards. It was a strange feeling to do a scene with people and realize they're not even looking at me. We're having a conversation in the scene and the person is talking to me, but they're just never looking at me. They're only deadlocked right on a cue card, so that when the camera cuts to them, it looks like they're looking right at me, so those technical things become a little easier after the first time. John Mulaney. I introduced Jesse Eisenberg to Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg was on the show, Eisenberg had just played him in The Social Network, and they'd never met. Zuckerberg claimed he never saw the movie, and he was going to do an appearance in the monologue. Just by being the writer on the monologue, I'm in charge of it. So I remember getting Jesse, who was hosting, from his dressing room and telling him, "Let's go run it with Mark." I remember bringing Jesse in there with Zuckerberg. Without realizing what I was about to do, I just knocked on the door and said, "Hey, Mark Zuckerberg, Jesse Eisenberg." They're both similar in age, both very nice and polite, maybe on the quiet side. And then I just started laughing so hard, because I couldn't believe that I was the one introducing these two guys. Then Lorne came in and we rehearsed it. There was a lot of money in that room at that moment.
Vanessa Bayer. One thing you do not think about at all when you're auditioning is that you're going to meet different hosts and musical guests every week. You don't think about the fact that there's going to be some huge celebrity and huge musical group at the show every week, and you have to be sort of cool around them. You don't want to go, "Oh man, I love you so much." I think I've gotten pretty good at acting cool.
Justin Timberlake. Jimmy's the only guy who gets me to break. Actually, I break more than you would think. I broke one time doing one of the Barry Gibb sketches. I broke on the Family Feud sketch because Jimmy holds the record for breaking on the show, and while the cameras weren't on him when you see me break, it's because I can see in the corner of my eye that he is doubled over, he's laughing so hard. And it just became this thing. For that sketch, it was kind of a serendipitous moment. I'm imitating Jimmy, and Jimmy's there laughing, and so I guess in a nutshell, it explains when Jimmy and I are together on live television, all bets are off. With the Barry Gibb sketches, it got to a point where we didn't even rehearse it. We kind of just goofed off in rehearsal because we knew that we were going to kind of go off the cuff with each other. It's one of the few times where Lorne is okay with sort of improvisation within the midst of all these jokes that they've been crafting for a whole week. Because I think that you know, with Jimmy and I, there's a certain thing to it, especially when it's just Jimmy. I don't think I could take much credit for it, to be honest with you. I mean, there is a certain thing that happens with him where it's almost like the more he breaks, the funnier the sketch gets. It's a weird thing. Jimmy Fallon, host. Going back to host is a dream come true. It gets even better if you can believe that. I went back to host, and I got the flu. I was so nervous, I think, about hosting that I got sick. I was just overthinking everything. I asked Tina to come and write something with me and Rachel, and of course she did. It was like this is where you grew up, so it's like asking your buddies to reunite for a little bit. It meant so much to me as a fan of the show, and I just love that it all came back. We did the Christmas song with Horatio, and it was really kind of a moment. Also, we did a great sketch written by Seth Meyers, where it was Beethoven and he was introducing his band. It was one of my favorite things that I've ever seen, because Sudeikis, Armisen, we threw in Catan, Horatio, and everyone scored. We were having a really good time, and I said to myself, everyone's in on this. This is a fun night. That's the best when you get those vibes, when Studio 8H is rocking so hard that it shakes, the stage actually shakes. The only other time that's happened that way to me was when I did a sketch with Mick Jagger, where I was in the mirror looking back at Mick. We wrote that on a Friday night. It was a last-minute sketch. And when we finished, the place was shaking. People were standing up, clapping. I'll never forget that. Horatio Sanz, cast member. When we went back and did the Christmas thing, they put us all in the same room, so that was very awkward. Tracy had recently written that book where he said something about Catan being a jerk or not being nice to people or something. I don't know what it was, but Catan's father had just died and the book came out pretty much around the same time. So Catan came in guns a-blazin' like, "Yeah, Tracy, thanks for saying I'm an asshole in a book, but my dad fucking died." He just kept doing bits about it, but you could tell he was pissed off. Then Tracy came in. Tracy says a lot of things that I don't think he thinks much about. I don't think he really hated Catan as much as he was like, Those guys were assholes to me, so I'll fuck them up a little bit. Obviously, Tracy didn't know about Catan's dad. Anyway, I guess Shoemaker told them, "Hey guys, why don't you talk it out if you're going to be in the same room for 4 days?" And they ironed it out. It had mostly been just bad timing. I think Catan was not in the best place to get blasted in a book. He ended up doing fine, but it was awkward.
Zoe Deschanel. I once saw Chris Farley in the gym when I was like 16. He was at the gym that my parents belonged to. I was on the treadmill, and it was so exciting. He was just walking around the gym, doing bits. I've been watching SNL since I was a kid, when it was on too late for me to stay up, so I would tape it and watch it. I would see the doors that the hosts walked through, and watch them walk down the aisle between the band members. It looks totally different when you're back there. It's flat, like a set. It looks like backstage. It's a facade. You're back there, and they have a little monitor, and they say, "Okay, go now!" And then you're saying to yourself, "Oh my God, I'm hosting SNL right now!" Between sketches, you get grabbed. It's like when you're in kindergarten and you hold on to the next kid to you. You have to hold on to Donna, the dresser, and she'll lead you through the maze behind the sets, and then you get changed where everybody's changing back there. It's amazing.